There are a bunch of people in bed this morning that are not able to achieve the victory you did when we all got up out of bed. We need to appreciate the blessings, and we need to realize that we have a lot more blessings than we think we do, and a lot more blessings than we have burdens, that's for sure. Proverbs 17 says that a merry heart does good like medicine. So I always like for us to share a little levity to lighten our burdens. Let me share with you a prayer. If you want a copy of this, and maybe you'd like to pray this prayer on a daily basis, I'll share it with you. I'll get a copy for you. Good morning, Lord. So far today, I've done all right. I haven't gossiped. I haven't lost my temper. I haven't been grumpy, greedy, nasty, selfish, or overindulgent. I'm very thankful for that. But in a few minutes, Lord, I'm going to be getting up out of bed. And from then on, I'm going to need a lot of help. Please be with me. Amen. Hey, you men will appreciate this story. This is probably my favorite story of a lighthearted nature. There was this store that was selling husbands. It had opened up in New York City, had several floors. The store was composed of six floors. The men increase in positive attributes as the shopper ascends the flights. There is, however, a catch. If you go to this store to hunt a husband, as you open the door to any floor, you may choose a man from that floor. But if you go up a floor, you cannot come back down except to exit the building. So, a woman goes to the shopping center to find a husband. On the first floor, the sign on the door reads, "Floor 1, these men have jobs." The woman reads the sign and says to herself, "Well, that's better than my last boyfriend. But I wonder what's further up." So up she goes. Second floor. The sign reads on the door, "Floor 2. These men have jobs and love kids." The woman remarks to herself, "That's great. But I wonder what's up on the next floor." So she goes up to the next floor, floor 3. The sign says, "These men have jobs, love kids, and are extremely good looking." This is a lot better, she says. "But I wonder what's upstairs." She chooses to go to the fourth floor. Floor 4, the sign says, "These men have jobs, love kids, are extremely good looking, and help with housework." "Whoa," she exclaims, "that's very tempting, but there must be more further up." And again, she heads up to another flight. Floor 5, the sign says, "These men have jobs, love kids, are extremely good looking, help with the housework, and have a strong romantic streak." "Oh, mercy me," she says. "But just think, what must be awaiting me on the next floor?" So she goes up to the sixth floor, and the sign on the door says, "You are visitor 6,875,953,012 to this floor. There's no men on this floor. This floor exists solely for the purpose of proving women are impossible to please." Oh boy, that's not literally true. But it can feel like it sometimes. You know, we talked about yesterday, sometimes our feelings are not always consistent with reality. And boy, that is so very true. Hey, I want to ask a question about your storm experience. Give me the worst storm experience that you've ever experienced. Who can top everybody else in this room? The worst storm experience you've been through. Now, I'm not talking about a storm of life. I'm talking about a meteorological event. Hurricane, tornado. Who's experienced something really rough in the way of a storm? Okay. Hurricane Andrew. Okay. Hurricane Andrew. How did that affect you? Did you lose anything? You lost your house in Hurricane Andrew. We talked about that yesterday, about, you know, how the loss of a house could really do a number on you for a lot of different reasons. You know, the people, the relationships, the experiences in that house, the things that you lose, the possessions in your house. Well, that caused some serious grief. Anybody else, a storm experience? You all probably don't even know about a blizzard. Those of you who were around yesterday know about the Golden Chest of Prizes that has all kinds of really neat things in it, like this rubber hammer and a whoopee cushion, and there's all kinds of things. There's a book in here. There's some hot pads in here. We're going to have Ron take this to her and to him because of their stories, and let you can pick out the two of you raise your hand so Ron notices where to go. And you can dig as deep as you'd like to in that Golden Chest of Prizes, and you can take something home with you. Boy, storms. Whew.
She took the hammer.
She took the hammer. Oh, now, don't you leave without me taking a picture of you and your hammer, okay? Did you get the whoopee cushion?
Cow mask.
Cow mask, okay. He picked out a cow mask, okay? You know, life can be so hard and so difficult and so stressful. It is just so important that occasionally we have some lighthearted times just to lift our spirits. It can just help us catch another breath. And sometimes that's all we need to do. We just need to keep breathing when things are really bad. And some things that can help you keep breathing are the lighthearted times that we experience in life. Let's spend a moment in prayer before we start. Father in heaven, we thank you for a time to spend together thinking about some things that are really difficult to think about and to talk about and even harder to experience. Father, we pray that with the losses that we experience in this life, that we can experience some learning as a result of it. Help us, Father, to have the wisdom and the strength to make some good decisions, some wise decisions, in the midst of the heartbreaking losses that we can experience in this life. Father, thank you for your patience with us, your long-suffering, your understanding. We're so thankful that you know our frame and the struggles that we have in this life. Father, help us to sense your presence in our life all the time, but especially when we're struggling. Help us by faith to sense that presence, and from that sensing of that presence, find a greater sense of courage and hope for our lives. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Katrina was a bad one. 2005, Category 3, and we all saw a lot of that on the news and what happened as a result of that just terrible experience down there. Buffalo, New York is noted for some serious snow. I love Buffalo, New York, and love Niagara Falls even more. But can you imagine 6 feet of snow? 6 feet of snow. Man, that's a lot of snow. But that can happen, depending on where you live. And these horrible tornadoes that sometimes are experienced. Look at that devastation. You know, we talked about loss of home, the struggle that goes with those losses. So difficult. If you go back there and you look at these three, what is similar about all three of those? What is similar about all three of those that we showed you? Anybody?
Devastation,
things?
Misery.
There's misery that comes with loss. Now, what about this picture here? I took this picture just last week. My family was in Miramar Beach, right next to Destin, and when I was walking one morning, I saw this structure, and I thought, man, I got to take a picture of that. That's really interesting. Now, I want you to look at those two pictures of that same building. Now, what do you observe when you look at those pictures? Where is that structure? Okay, it's on the beach. Okay. What's really great about being at the beach? It's a beautiful place, isn't it? What's not so good sometimes being at the beach? Yeah, there can be some pretty rough times come as a result of being next to a place like that. You know, you can go out there at sunrise and sunset, and boy, the sunsets last week were just amazing at that location. But you can go out there and you can just see the awesomeness of God's natural revelation of himself. It's just so impressive, so impactful. But things can go south real quick at a place like that. There are meteorological events that occur that create danger times. Now, when you look at that building and you look at the location of that building, what does that tell you about the particular storm that this building experienced? What do you know about the storm? It was pretty severe, wasn't it? That picture on the left side is the side facing the beach. Now, do you think that there was any preparation in regard to that building and the exposure with that storm that came through there? Do you think they did any prepping? Can you imagine having a piece of property in a building close to a location like that and not prepping your investment in some way? But look at the severity of the damage. You know, nobody is going to buy property at a location like that without thinking about the possibilities. It's an investment. You can lose an investment. You want to protect yourself from the loss of the investment, so you want to do everything you can. You want to have the insurance, and then if you know ahead of time that that storm is coming, you'll want to prep for that storm. Now, for all the severe damage that occurred to that structure, what can you say real positive about that structure? It's still standing, isn't it? It's still standing. I want to suggest to you that when we experience a storm in our life, that the only goal that you need to focus on, the only goal that we need to focus on is survival. That's all. There was a movie years ago called The Perfect Storm. I was pretty tense watching that movie. The computer graphics in that movie were outstanding. Anybody who watched that movie, do you know how that movie ended? It was a horrific storm. They were out there in the ocean. Does anybody remember how that movie ended? They all died. No survivors, not a single one. I thought surely one of them. I was really pulling for one guy. But none of them survived. Whenever you're in a perfect storm in your life, when it's just unimaginable, you know, something that you never dreamed that you would ever experience before in your life, what you need to shoot for is survival. You know, I think there are times we expect way too much of ourselves. I think, for instance, to use the word coping is way too high of a bar to set in regard to dealing with the storms of life. Because you know what you have to do before you learn to cope? Is you got to survive. If you don't survive, there's no sense even dealing with or talking about coping. Survival comes before coping, and coping comes in the process of growing. But you've got to survive first. What we need to do sometimes so that we are helping ourselves is no matter how much life experience we have, no matter how long that we've been a Christian, no matter how much we love the Lord, we have to remember that we're human beings. Human beings have issues. We all have issues. We all have vulnerabilities and weaknesses, and we struggle. And some people struggle more with certain things than other people do. But we've got to understand that we're not going to react like a machine reacts. Given a certain set of circumstances, you can predict how a machine's going to react. But that's not the case with human beings. With human beings, remember, we have a thinker and we have a feeler. And our human condition creates a real difficult struggle when we're experiencing a storm in our life. It could be a cancer diagnosis. It could be the loss of somebody very close to us in our life, a family member, a sibling. It could be a parent. It could be the fact that we've lost our marriage by divorce. and crushed by that. A job that we dearly loved and appreciated. There are a lot of storms that we experience in life. And what we've got to understand is, I think it's wonderful to have great expectations in your life. I am a sun, moon, and stars kind of guy. My attitude and philosophy of life is shoot for the sun, moon, and stars, and then settle for what you have to. But shoot for the sun, moon, and stars. There are some exceptional times in your life, though, when it's way better to shoot low. Because if you have too high of expectations, you're going to probably be very frustrated, maybe even angry with yourself that you didn't achieve or experience what you thought you should have. Whenever you're experiencing a storm in your life, just survive. Sometimes the goal of a day is keep breathing. Just breathe. That's all you have to do. Whenever we've suffered loss, I mean a big loss, a severe loss, what we've got to understand is we're in an ICU time in our life. We're in a critical care situation. We have got to give ourselves that critical care. We've got to be willing to accept the critical care that other people can provide. We're not a regular patient out there on the normal floor. We're in an ICU. And we've got to accept that fact. We're going to struggle. Loss is inevitable. You cannot avoid loss in this world. I'd like for us to talk about a phrase that commonly surfaces whenever people experience severe losses in their life. And that phrase is the Lord's will. There are a lot of times that I've heard people in their attempts to minister to folks who have experienced losses, that they have attempted to comfort that person in their experience of loss by saying, well, you know, it was the Lord's will. Now, let me ask you, when you hear that kind of comment or observation, well, you know, this must have been the Lord's will. What do people think when you say that? Most people think. Now, one of the things, as you're thinking about that, and I'm going to ask you for oral response here. Whenever we're talking to people, we've got to remember that we have an intended message, and hopefully we get across the first hurdle, and we take that intended message and we actually express it as we intended. But even when we do that, there's a receiver of the message. The receiver of the message has his or her own issues too. And even if you are able in words to express the message the way that you intended, that doesn't necessarily mean that the message that you intended is the message received. The message received can be very different than what your intention was. That's why we struggle with our communication. I think one of the hardest things we human beings do is communicate effectively. That's why it's so hard to preach. You know, you're up there preaching to a bunch of people. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for us guys who do this kind of thing, but it's really difficult. You've got all these people sitting around here, and they've got all these different personalities and different degrees of faith and different kinds of life experiences. It can be very difficult. I think it's probably realistically impossible to communicate effectively with everybody. You just hope you get the best out of the situation and you help the most people you possibly can. But it's hard to communicate effectively. So when somebody says, well, it must have been the Lord's will, how do you think people can interpret that? How can they receive that message? What does it mean to them? Anybody? Yes, ma'am. So somebody would say something about, well, it must have been the Lord's will, and then you would think, how can you know that? Even worse, okay, Ron, God doesn't like me. Oh, yeah, okay, he must not like me. Why would they come to that conclusion, he must not like me? What are they suggesting about God's participation in that person's life? That it was his idea and it was his desire. Why would a God who's good and just want to inflict pain on other people? God sits on the throne, right? He is sovereign. He calls the shots. Sunday morning, tomorrow morning, Lord willing, we're going to talk about the million-dollar question when we're suffering with the struggle of living after loss or just generally struggling when our life goes south. What is the million-dollar question? I'm not sure that we understand that, what the million-dollar question is. But there sure are questions, aren't there, that pop up. And especially if you have any degree of faith-based nature to yourself, suffering loss will change your theology because of your experience. It will change your theology. You will look at things differently about the world and about God. Now, that could be a good thing, and that could also be a bad thing, depending on how you struggle with that issue.
I'd like to share a story, if we have a few moments at the right time, about a time when the Lord didn't answer my prayer, and I got mad at him and had a real hard time praising him, even because of what he chose not to do for me. You know, have you ever thought about that, about, you know, our perspective about God and our petitioning God in our times of agony and struggle, and especially loss? We're praying one thing, and then what are other people praying? And how can God answer everybody's prayer the way they want? I mean, he is God, but I mean, there are some things, you know, you just can't do. You can't answer everybody's prayer when those prayers are conflicting, answer them in the way that they want them to be answered. Over here there was a...
Yeah, we reap what we sow. Sow to the flesh, reap corruption. Sow to the spirit, life everlasting. That theory of retribution, that is a really a heavy part of that story of Job, at least in regard to the perspective of his three friends, it was. Let me share with you some a couple of different kinds of ways that Lord's will is used in the Bible. Let me ask you about this one, and I'm sure this is a familiar passage to a lot of you. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. God is not willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. God is not willing. What does that mean? Well, it's God's desire, isn't it? It's God's desire. He desires that everyone repent. That's his desire. That everyone repent and everyone be saved. That's his desire. By the way, is his desire going to be fulfilled? There's a broad way that leads to destruction, and many are on that trail. But it is his desire. The Lord's will is used that way in the Bible. The Lord's will. Now, there's another in James, in the book of James, at the end of James chapter 4. Let me read to you a little segment here of James chapter 4. It's another way that that terminology is used. James 4, verse 13, starting. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. You can just imagine them being in the boardroom and having their maps and their sticks and their markers and, you know, marking off, we're going to go here and then we're going to go there. And they even make it a point of saying they're going to make a profit. I mean, they are cocksure about everything here. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Except you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. If the Lord wills. When I started going to church when I was 15 years old, one of the things I remember about the old people, back then it was probably people 40 years and older. My definition of old people is anybody 10 years or more older than me. That way I never will be. But I remember a lot of those old guys getting up and in their prayers, they would talk about this terminology, about if the Lord wills. And I remember hearing them in conversation even at the church building on occasion in talking about future things. They would use that very terminology, if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that. Then I met some people from West Virginia. People in West Virginia roll a little bit different if you don't know about them. And they would say, Lord willing and the creek don't rise. Or creek, depending on what side of the Ohio River you lived on. Lord willing and the creek don't rise. In other words, there was a cloak of uncertainty. If the Lord wills. You know, there's a difference between the Lord's permissive will and then the Lord's will in regard to his desire. God does have desires, just like we have desires, and we're created in his image. God has desires. But God also created us in such a fashion as that we can call our own shots. We can decide what we want to do and how we want to react to the things that we experience in our life. And he will permit us to react that way. Do you think it was God's desire for Eve to eat the forbidden fruit? Do you think it was God's desire for one of their two children to take the life of their other child? Do you think it's God's desire for families to deal with domestic violence, for drunks to go left of center on the road and take the life of innocent people? Did God permit those things to happen, though? You know, when this kind of stuff gets personal, it becomes a much greater challenge. Did the Lord want my wife to be diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in her early 50s, to struggle with that decline for 8.5 years, and then die on Christmas morning of 2013? Was that what the Lord desired? How would I ever know that? Now, did the Lord permit that? He sure did. He could have stopped it. It didn't have to happen. He could have stopped it, but he let it happen. His permissive will, he permitted it to happen. You know, sometimes when our kids are growing up, and, you know, when they're little, you have total control. You're bigger, faster, and stronger. As they grow up, what happens is you start losing control, but hopefully, as you're losing control, you're banking influence in their life. Because there's going to come a time when you have no control over them, and hopefully what you're going to do is you're going to take withdrawals out of that bank of influence and help to impact their life in a positive way. But when they're growing up, you know, there is a situation where you start losing control. And there does come a time sometimes when a parent will see their child make a choice and go a certain direction, and you could stop it. But maybe you think and reflect, maybe I ought to just let this happen. Maybe they need this experience. There was a lady, a dear friend of mine, whose adult son chose to be a homosexual. And to this day, my heart bleeds for that boy's parents. I love them dearly. And one of the things that I told her in talking to her on the phone one day, I said, Laura, I said, you know, my prayer for Nate is that Nate will experience whatever he needs to experience so that he will see things differently. Now, that's a scary prayer. What will it take to cause a person to look at something differently? I remember sitting in a Bible class where we were talking about the plagues of Egypt. I wasn't teaching the class. I was a student in the class. And just to kind of bring a little levity to the situation in talking about those plagues, I made the observation. I said, Pharaoh was a man. It took 10 plagues to convince him to look at things differently and finally permit the Israelites to leave. I said, if Pharaoh was a woman, how many plagues would it have taken? One woman immediately said one. She would have got it a lot earlier. You know, sometimes you wonder, what will it take to cause a person to change their perspective? It is a scary prayer. I have prayed for some people that way, that the Lord would work in their life so that they would experience whatever it is they need to experience. And that could be a tragedy. It could be a terrible tragedy. That they would either experience something or meet someone who would be able to impact them so dramatically that they would change their perspective about something. There's a difference between God permitting something and then God desiring something. Sometimes as a parent, at a certain point, you just kind of let the child experience something that you know is going to be a train wreck. This is going to be a train wreck. And so you're just prepared. You know, you prepare yourself to pick up the pieces and try to put things back together again. But you're hoping that that experience will be something they'll react to in such a way as that they'll come out of this a whole lot wiser and a whole lot stronger than they ever were. That's what you hope. There are things that God could stop from happening, but he permits them to happen. Let me share with you a philosophy. There was a guy named T. Pierce Brown who wrote an article in the Gospel Advocate publication in the 1970s. I read this article. It's about Romans 8:28. All things work together for good. I'm sure many of you know that passage. And it helped me to formulate this particular perspective. I think this is a very good philosophy of life. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will. Now, what I mean by using it that way is God's desire. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will. It is in the sense that he permitted it, but it's not in the sense that he desired it. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. He does have a desire. Do you know what God's will is when you suffer adversity? It is the same as when you suffer with loss, one of the greatest adversities, and it's the same as when you are experiencing awesome prosperity to glorify him and to be a blessing to others. That's consistently the Lord's will. You are not blessed so that you'll be happy. Now, I'm sorry if that's a disappointment to you. God's not nearly as concerned about your happiness as he is your holiness. You're not blessed so you can be happy. You're not burdened to be sad. We experience blessings and burdens so that we can glorify God and be a blessing to others. That needs to be the consistent way we live our life. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. What is God's will for me when my wife gets Parkinson's disease? It's to be a caregiver. One of the most touching communications I ever got, it was by email, was from Ron McQuinn about his caregiving experience with his wife, Karen. Caregiving is a very difficult experience. Super stressful, physically exhausting, spiritually challenging. It is by far the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. There's nothing that compares with it. Living in widowhood doesn't compare with being a caregiver. For me, at least, not. The Lord permitted that to occur. And my choice was to react to that diagnosis of hers. I need to be a caregiver. Because I said in sickness and in health. By the way, not everybody does that. Not everybody does that. You know, I've heard people say, well, I didn't have a choice. Yes, you did have a choice. And you chose to be faithful. You chose to do what one woman, she was described this way, this wonderful woman up in the Weirton, West Virginia area. Her husband was a preacher, and he was afflicted. He was in a wheelchair for a long time. She, a high school English teacher, she took care of him. She pushed him around in a wheelchair all over the place, and they were just a great team. She was a full-time teacher, and he was severely handicapped. And eventually, he died. Before he died, when she was ministering to him in the hospital, and she's still working full time, she would be with him all night long at the hospital. And in the morning, she'd take a shower, and she'd go teach her English class. And then she'd come back to the hospital, and she'd minister to her husband. And she did that day in and day out. On Facebook one day, one of her Facebook friends described her this way. I thought this was such a neat comment to make about somebody. This guy, this friend of hers, said of Betty, she hoed her row to the end. Isn't that a neat thing? She hoed her row. You know the agricultural, the farming metaphor? She hoed her row to the end. Not everybody hoes their row to the end. But Betty did, because she said, until death do us part. Well, preparation for storm. I know that this is a very common passage of scripture. It's at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And I realize that there is a really cute song that we sing with a bunch of little kids. But it's way more than a little kid's story. Let me read to you this passage of scripture, and I want to ask you a question about this. Verse 24, starting in Matthew 7. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does them, and does not do them, will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Now, what house is he talking about there? You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, which is the Magna Carta of Christianity, he talks about this is the way we ought to be, and this is how we ought to behave. Christianity is an inside-out kind of life experience and lifestyle. So he's talked about it. Here's how we ought to be, and here's how we ought to behave. And now he finishes up talking about a contractor business and the building of a house. What's the house in this metaphor? He's talking about your life. Talking about your life. I have heard people say that there is nothing that can prepare you for the loss of your spouse. I've heard people say there's nothing that can prepare you for the loss of your child. Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a man who built his house on the rock. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Yes or no? See, now it's getting personal, isn't it? What do we mean when we say there's nothing that could prepare you for blank? What do we mean when we say that? We've never experienced it before, okay? Anybody else? What are we trying to say there? There's nothing that can prepare you for blank. There's no paradigm, there's no perspective where you can see yourself going through that and handling it right. That depth of loss, that depth of sorrow. Not expecting the unexpected. Okay. I think part of our problem with that perspective goes back to this idea of expecting too much of yourself. You know, well, let me ask you this. What could prepare somebody to go from being single to being married? Now, let's be honest here. Nothing, exactly. Nothing. Why would you? And by the way, I love, one of the things I love to do is talk to people about how they met, their story of life and love. And I like to ask them about where they met, how they met, and about their life together. And especially when they're an older couple, I will often end that conversation this way. I will say, did you know what you were doing when you said I do? I always get the same response. They burst out laughing, and they say, how could we have? How could we have known? You know, but we go from being single to being married, and some of us live our entire lives, the rest of our lives, until death do us part. We do it, don't we? But yet we say, man, there's nothing that could prepare yourself. Well, there's nothing that could prepare yourself fully, totally. So it's like a glitchless transition from single to being married. The same thing is true about, have you ever, probably you haven't, and I understand why, because I didn't for decades. If you believe that there's any value in premarital counseling, and by the way, I would never officiate at a wedding ceremony without extensive premarital counseling. That's why I didn't have to do too many. But I was convinced that premarital counseling, though it would not totally prepare them for everything they experienced, I thought it would lower the risk and help them tremendously to build a better foundation and have a little bit smoother, not totally smooth, but a little less rocky transition from being single to being married. Now, if we believe that, what about transitioning from being married to being widowed? Do we talk about that one? If we see the value, the potential value of premarital counseling to help a person going from single to married, don't you think there's a value in talking about living with loss to transition from married to widowed? Do you know how you get widowed? The first step in getting widowed is saying, I do. Every married person is a prospective widowed person. Now, I never thought about that until a few years ago. But you see, I think what we often mean, when we talk about nothing can prepare you for it, I think you're right about the sense of the experience of the depth of sorrow, the degree of tension, the experience of exhaustion, like unparalleled, like you've never had before. It's just unimaginable. And so it's not like maybe we thought it might be. You know, there's a lot of difference between talking about this kind of stuff when you're in a church house and you're talking about struggling with life circumstances and then going outside the building and living it. It's a lot different. I think you can be prepared for anything in your life. But remember that this structure survived. And if you have what you need to survive, that's the first step in living with loss. That's the first step. If you want to survive a loss in your life, a terribly turbulent time in your life, then what you need to do is do what Jesus said. Listen to me. Absorb those things, you know, receive with meekness that implanted word. Let it be buried within you. Let it become who you are and how you live and what guides you in your life. Let that happen. And you know what? You can survive anything. Literally anything in your life. You can prepare to the extent that you can survive. And that's what you need to do. That's the first step in living with loss, is survival. That's all you have to do. Some days, all you got to do is breathe. You navigate a storm, you somehow survive, and then what happens as a result of that? Well, if you survive, that builds courage, because you know what? Here's the way I often talk in my widowhood workshop ministry with widowed people. When they are they're in an awful phase in their life, could be an awful day, but an awful phase in their life. And they very transparently talk about that. After they talk about it, one thing I will mention to them is I said, okay, now think about the worst days of your life previous to today. What did you do with every worst day of your life up to this point? You survived. That bodes well for your future. You have survived all of your terribly difficult days in the past. You've survived every single one of them. And that's all you have to do to be able to get to the next step. That builds courage. And that gives you hope that, yeah, I can handle these things. But the problem is you got to deal with all these feelings. And you have all this confusing stuff that goes on inside of you. And it causes you to doubt yourself. It causes you to feel very stressed. You feel very weak, and you struggle with worry and concerns that you've never struggled with before. Have you ever thought about Jesus and some of the things said about him? A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. We sometimes sing, Jesus knows just how I feel. You know, in the garden, being in agony, he was grieving. He was praying and grieving in that situation. Matthew 23 is some of the strongest terminology you'll ever read that fell from the lips of Jesus. Man, he just ripped up one side and down the other, the scribes, the Pharisees, and the hypocrites. At the end of that chapter, he grieves. He grieves about the fact that they were not receptive to him. And isn't it comforting what the Hebrew writer says? We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize. There's that double negative. God gets away with double negatives, but you can't do it in English class. So we do have a high priest who can sympathize with our weaknesses. Jesus knows just how I feel. That's why when we're experiencing loss, our greatest need to help us survive is the Lord. But we need to prepare for that. We need to cultivate that relationship with him. Forced change is inevitable. Change generally is inevitable. Forced change, which is another way of talking about loss, is inevitable. Growth in the experience of life after loss is intentional. You have to decide that. Not everybody grows with change. Some people die with change. I talked about one of the mottos of the ministry I have is don't die until you're dead. You've got to decide that you're not going to die, that you're going to live. You have to choose, intentionally choose, to live a meaningful life after loss and not just exist. We'll conclude this particular session with this. This is a great book, A Grace Disguised. It's back there on that table display. Loss provides an opportunity to take inventory of our lives, to reconsider our priorities, to determine new directions. Deep sorrow is good for the soul. It doesn't feel good. That's an unpleasant feeling. But deep sorrow can be very good for the soul. Let's take a break. About 7 or 8 minutes, we'll call you back. Feel free to go out there and get some refreshments. By the way, something I didn't mention, there's a table up here in the front of the auditorium. It has a bunch of handout sheets on it. You're welcome to come up and feel free to take anything there from the table that you would like. There's a lot of good stuff up there. I don't want to force it on you. I don't want to pass it out. You can take it if you'd like it. You don't have to, but feel free to take anything you'd like there on that table. Deep sorrow is good for the soul. It's not pleasant, but it can be really good for the soul. And grief is deep sorrow. I made the observation yesterday that loss is one thing, living with loss is another thing. Loss is brutal, loss is hard, loss is painful, but living with loss is a everyday, every night struggle. Living with something that you can't change, that's the bigger challenge. Let's talk a little bit about living with loss. May I ask what may seem to be a very elementary question? Why do we grieve? You have any thoughts about that? Why do we grieve? How would you answer that question? It's in our nature. Okay, somebody else? Why do we grieve? It's in our nature. What else? It's cleansing, okay? Interesting. It's cleansing. It's a relief. Because we loved. Good answer. Yes, ma'am. It helps us remember, okay? How many of you saw any of the monster movies? Monsters, Inc. or Monsters University? Okay. Sully is my favorite. One of the ways that I describe this experience of loss is the grief monster comes to visit at your house. He's uninvited, but the grief monster comes to your house. Now, when a monster that shows up at your house, you're going to feel threatened. You're going to feel uncomfortable. You're going to feel at risk. You're going to struggle with a lot of internal issues because an uninvited monster has come to your house. Now, when we've lost somebody in our life or something really important in our life, the grief monster has come to our house. Now, let me ask you a question. Is he your friend or is he your enemy? Both. Yes. Okay. Somebody else says yes. Yes. Grief. When the grief monster comes to visit at your house, initially he's scary and he's threatening. And again, remember, he's uninvited. You know, we don't choose loss. We're forced to deal with it. It shows up in our life. Well, when the grief monster comes to your house, what we need to learn to do is benefit from the presence of the grief monster. And get to the point where we hug the grief monster. Now, Sully in the Monsters, Inc. and Monsters University movies, like I said, is my favorite. He's adorable. He looks very threatening. He's big. But he actually is a very good monster. The grief monster, when he comes to visit at your house, you have no idea, by the way, how long he's going to stay either. Don't you just love it when people come to your house and you can't get rid of them? You know, you'd like to kind of exit them out, but you can't get rid of them. The grief monster comes, and he's going to stay, and you have no idea how long. And what we need to do is appreciate the value of having this visit and even learn to hug the grief monster because it is very therapeutic. There is a reason why we grieve. Somebody had made the observation, because we loved. We grieve because we've lost something that we love. If you lose something you don't love, it's not a big deal. But if you lose something of value, then that makes a difference in your life. Now, how do you estimate the value of something? Now, if it's a house, you know, you go on Zillow or some other app and you find that information. But how do we value things? Now, I remember going to Will Rogers Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I saw some stuff in that museum that I looked at and I thought, man, I got some of the same stuff in my house, in my garage. You know, some old shoes and but what made that stuff really valuable and in that museum was because of who owned it. The value was related to who owned it. It was pretty much just worthless, but it was who owned it. I bet you have some things that have very special value to you. This catcher's mitt of mine, it's a Spalding catcher's mitt, is a prized possession of mine. I used this when I was a teenager and I was catching. Now, I'm willing to admit this and even go on record to saying I'm 68 years old. Okay, so this is ancient. As a matter of fact, I was such a poor kid. This is a shoestring back here. I didn't even have the money to buy, you know, the cowhide shoestring that you would typically use for something like that. But this is my catcher's mitt. It's in the back of my car everywhere I go. And when I come down here, my grandson, Evan, who for some reason roots for the Boston Red Sox. I don't understand that. He should be rooting for the Tampa Bay Rays. But anyway, he pitches. He's a left-handed pitcher. He wants to be a relief pitcher for the Boston Red Sox. And so I'll get down there and I'll catch him. And I just love doing that with my catcher's mitt. This is one of my prized possessions of life. Now, if I were to put this on eBay to sell, nobody in their right mind would buy it, I don't think. But it has great value to me. I would hate to lose this. Now, this valuing things, the reason why this is important to me is because of this verse. For where your treasure is, what does it say? There will your heart be also. Your heart follows your treasures. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Our heart follows our treasures. That's why people get off track spiritually in their faith journey. Is they, in their heart, value some things too highly and permit those things to attract them in a direction that they shouldn't go. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So you have these people in your life or these things in your life that you have in your heart invested in them. And so when you lose something that your heart's invested in, well, how is that going to make you feel? Well, you're going to struggle. In regard to people, if they didn't matter in your life, and there are people in our lives that they really don't matter to us. I mean, let's just be honest about it. You know, I know that we should love everybody, and we do. That's an intentional thing. We want everybody's best interest. But you know, in regard to, you know, people, there are people that don't matter to us much because we don't know them. But then there are people who really matter to us a lot. And if they matter to us a lot, then it's going to matter when they're gone. And it's going to have an impact in our life. We're going to be different. No human being goes through crises without being changed. It will have an impact on you. Loss is a crisis, and it is going to matter to us. I mentioned this yesterday. People, relationships, and experiences. That's life. It is so important that we cultivate healthy human relationships. There's so much of our life that's invested in these relationships. And when we lose people in our life that matter so much to us, it is going to do a number on us. For us to think somehow that we're just going to be able to flip a switch and, quote, move on, unquote, is unrealistic. The fact is, if you were able to participate in either one of yesterday's sessions, you know, there is forced change and there is new beginning, but there's a neutral zone in there. And in that neutral zone, when you're in that forest and you're trying to find your way to this new beginning, you're going to go through some really difficult times. You're going to have some days like you've never experienced before. You're going to have fears and doubts and concerns you've never experienced before. And it is going to be a really difficult time in your life. You just can't expect anything other than that. It's just going to be really, really difficult. You know, it's great a lot of times in life to have high expectations, but sometimes the best thing to do is just shoot to survive. I have been an admirer of Gary Smalley for many years. He's passed on now. He has a book called The DNA of Relationships, and in that book, at the end of every chapter, is this quote: life is relationships. The rest is just details. You want to know why you grieve? When we lose people, why it really matters to you, this is it. Because you know what's happened to your life? You've lost a part of your life. And this side of eternity, you'll never retrieve it. You know, sometimes in life, what happens is life shuts the door. And life locks the door. And there is nothing you can do to go to the other side. And you've got to deal with the reality of that closed door that's locked. And it takes a lot of time for us human beings to come to grips with that. Sometimes when you're in deep grief, all you can do is sit there and stare at what you just can't believe is a closed door. Now, after deep grieving, hopefully what we do is we think about, okay, is there some other doors? Is there another door that I can walk through? I can't go through this one. Is there another one? There is a little frame out there on that table display, a quote of Helen Keller's. I encourage you to take a look at it, about when one door closes. But for a while, all we can do is look at the closed door. But there comes a time when we've got to understand we've got to start looking for an open door, another direction in our life. Life plus love plus loss equals grief. That's the way it is. When we become attached to things in our life or attached to people in our life and we lose them, it's going to matter to us, and that experience is what we human beings call grief. It's when the grief monster comes to visit at your house. Now, what that causes is what I call confliction, a lot of internal confliction. Okay, now, my wife has suffered with Parkinson's disease for 8.5 years. At 9:40 in the morning on December 25 of 2013, she breathes her last breath. Where is she? She's absent from the body. She's present with the Lord. She's where I would love to be. It's where she desired to be. So why in the middle of January, about 3 weeks after she passed away, why did I sit there on the couch at an empty house, nobody else there, and I experienced something I'd never experienced before? I spontaneously said something out loud in an empty house. I said, "What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me?" You know, I'd studied about grief, and I'd even taught classes about the problem of human suffering and about dealing with grief and all that sort of thing. But now I was experiencing it in a way I'd never experienced it before. I'd lost my father. I'd lost my mother. I lost my father-in-law. So here she's in a better place. She's with the Lord in a sense that she's never had before. And I'm in misery. Why should I be in misery if she is so blessed? See this confliction inside? This is, and so you start thinking, am I going crazy? Well, what I learned was I'm not going crazy, or crazier, maybe it would be a better way of putting it. I'm not going crazy, I'm grieving. That's what I'm doing, I'm grieving. When you're grieving, you're just not normal. You're not your normal self. You can't be. There's this confliction that goes on. We'll even talk a little bit about sometimes when people pass away, there can be as much relief as there is grief. And in some cases, there can be more relief than there is grief. It's weird. This grief causes a lot of internal confliction inside, and it really causes you to wonder about yourself. Doug Manning, in this book called Don't Take My Grief Away, I think has a great perspective here. Grieving is as natural as crying when you are hurt. You know, what do we do when we're hurt? We cry. Sleeping when we are tired, that is natural, that is normal. Eating when you're hungry, we do that all the time. We even eat when we're not hungry. Eating when you're hungry. Sneezing when your nose itches. Now look at that last line. It's nature's way. See, the grief monster is a friend. It's not your enemy. He looks like your enemy, but he's your friend. It's nature's way of healing a broken heart. You know, I'm not so sure that, you know, I do think that from a practical perspective, some people, they just decide they're not going to grieve. But actually, what they're doing when they choose that direction is they're just choosing not to experience it now. They're going to experience it. It's going to come eventually. But sometimes what happens is we will intentionally postpone it. We just don't want to deal with this. But you are going to experience it. You are going to experience grief. You may try to put it off. You may deny it. But you're going to experience it. It would be better to choose to grieve at that timely time, beginning right when you experience the loss. I love the foreword to C.S. Lewis's book, A Grief Observed. The human being is allowed to grieve. That is normal. It is right to grieve, and the Christian is not denied this natural response. But sometimes we think that because we're people of faith, that we shouldn't grieve. If my wife was with the Lord in a way she'd never been before, in a more intimate way than she'd ever experienced before, that doesn't stop me from grieving the fact that I can no longer hug her, I can no longer kiss her, I can no longer touch her, I can no longer see her, I can no longer hear her, I can no longer smell her. Just because, do you know what the problem is with being a Christian? I'll tell you what the problem is about being a Christian. You have to be a human too. If you didn't have to be a human, being a Christian would be a whole lot easier. But we're human beings, and we're Christians. And that sometimes the loss of a person in our life, in our faith walk, sometimes the loss of a person can be more difficult for us because of our faith orientation and our misunderstandings about what that means than people who have no faith. Because we have these expectations about people of faith. People of faith should react a certain way. Well, what you're dealing with here when it comes to loss is you're dealing with change. You're dealing with not chosen change, not cyclical or chronological change. What you're dealing with is forced change. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this grief business. What are we going to do when we're grieving? What are we going to do? How to Go On Living When Someone You Love Dies is a really great book. Again, it's out there on that display. You can expect to that grief affects you psychologically, socially, and physically. It's going to do a number on you. It's going to have an impact on you. You have to understand that, again, you're not a machine. You're a human being. This is going to dramatically affect you. And it's okay for it to dramatically affect you in a number of different ways. And again, you're not going crazy. Here is, an expectation or misunderstanding that really complicates the situation. When you hear about stages of grief in Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book back there, actually that book is about people who have been given diagnoses about them dying. It's not about people living with the loss of folks who have died. But anyway, studies like that, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and other ones, you'll hear a lot of times talk and you'll read things about what are called stages of grief. And one of the problems with that is, I think people think that it's just kind of like the phases of the moon. You know, one just naturally kind of follows another one. And you just know what's coming ahead and the way it's supposed to be. Grief is not like that. There are stages in grief, but it's not like that. It's not like predictable like that. It's more like this. It's more like chaos. It's very chaotic. It's kind of like getting involved in a maze. Let me tell you what happened in a co-op group. Homeschoolers have co-ops. I have three granddaughters who are homeschooled up outside of Atlanta, Georgia. They're involved in a co-op group, and that's a bunch of these families who have their kids together, and they have different special studies that they do when they do these co-op things. One day they did a field trip. This field trip was to a farm, and I drew myself under the bus, and I chose to become a chaperone on this field trip at this farm where these kids go, and they do all these really neat things at this farm. There was a maze there. There was a young lady who had two children, two boys. One was 9 and one was 11. And she was tied up with one of her other children. And these two boys, 9 and 11, wanted to go into the maze. And, you know, I heard about all this and I said, I'll take your boys into the maze. Oh, I had no idea what I was doing. But I didn't want the boys to be denied. I knew she was stressed about taking care of all the kids. I said, I'll go in the maze with the boys. It was an experience. Those boys, and what I chose to do, I just chose to follow them. I didn't give them any directions. I just chose to tag along to make sure they didn't die. I wanted to make sure that I could get them out of the maze eventually. And so they just went, it was bizarre. It was just, they just were all over the place. It was like one of those pinball machines. They were just like all over the place. I was thinking it would be good to stop and pray about my need to get out of there at some point in time. I don't know how long it took, but we finally got out of the maze. But it was a very chaotic experience. And grief is a very chaotic experience. And you can be in this maze with other people. And some of these other people could be very helpful. And some of these other people, not so helpful. But you're just working through this really strange time in your life. I don't know how many times I've talked to people in my ministry, the Widowhood Workshop ministry, where they will talk about how that they will have a really good day, and the next day will be the polar opposite. It'll just be awful. And then they'll expect the next day to be awful because that day was awful, and they wake up and they find out that that next day is a little bit better, but not as good as the first day that they referenced. It's very, very unpredictable. I remember pushing my wife in a place called the Hartville Kitchen, a beautiful, beautiful, big restaurant, has a bakery and a gift shop and all. She was in a wheelchair at this time, and I was pushing her through the bakery section. And as you go through the bakery section, at one point in time, we got into this candy section. Well, anyway, I was pushing her around, and I started tearing up, and I didn't say it aloud, but I thought to myself, what's wrong with me? What's going on? And then it dawned on me, I saw this peanut butter and chocolate fudge. When I see peanut butter and chocolate fudge, I think about my mother, because every Christmas, she made the best peanut butter and chocolate fudge. And that's what triggered my grief. Some people call them spasms, grief spasms. When we went to the Hartville kitchen that day, I had no plans to experience that. But it just happened. And it can happen at the strangest places, the most unpredictable places. But there are things that you may see, you may smell, or you may experience that will trigger grief. It will bring it to the surface. And that's not a bad thing. That's a very normal thing. And the reason why that happens is because we're human beings. We have people and relationships and experiences. And when we lose a part of our life, we're going to have experiences like that. Again, what you're dealing with is change. But it's not chosen change, it's forced change. The number one goal when you're dealing with forced change is survive. That's all you have to do. All you have to do is keep breathing. That is a tremendous success. If you can just survive the day and keep breathing through the day. And you know what's really good the next morning? If you can get up out of bed. You may have to stay there a little bit longer. But all you got to do is survive. All you got to do is keep breathing. Don't even think about coping. Don't even think about coping with this until you've strung a bunch of good days of successful survival. You just got to learn to survive. Don't shoot high. Just be reasonable. Sometimes it's good just to shoot low. Just survive the day. Eventually, what's going to happen is if you start stringing some days of survival together, what you're going to do is you're going to learn some coping skills that'll work for you. What works for you may not work for somebody else, but you're going to learn what works for you. You're going to find this out maybe through some people that you interact with, maybe through some Bible study or prayer time, or maybe being at church in a Bible class, or maybe a song that's sung that really touches you and causes you to be very reflective. It could be even something the preacher says. But you're going to learn some coping skills eventually. But you can't think about coping until you survive. You got to start crawling, and then you start walking, and then you start running. And what's going to happen eventually is if you survive and if you learn some coping skills, what's going to happen is you're going to grow. Because every storm that you navigate in your life, every storm that you survive, is going to cause you to be a little bit stronger, a little bit wiser, a little bit more courageous. And as a matter of fact, you're going to be better prepped to be a blessing to other people than you ever have been before. If you've always lived a life of, you know, just wonderful, positive blessings, how in the world are you ever going to be able to relate to people who are struggling with some really difficult times in your life? They can be such a blessing if we choose to convert the burden into a blessing. Grow, but that's an intentional thing. Survive and cope and grow. I think that is a great way of looking at life after loss. There's a secret that I found that came from an unusual source. A secret about life. It came from Alan Alda. The secret of life, and by the way, he's a Parkinson's patient. If you didn't know, he has been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. This is the MASH guy from the TV show. The secret of life is adapt, adjust, revise. Because the only thing you can be sure of is that everything is going to change. You know, things do change, don't they? And we don't get to choose all the changes that we experience. Sometimes they're thrust upon us. But things are going to change. So we've got to learn to do what your phone says. You know, when you plug in a destination in your phone, don't you just love it when it says rerouting? Rerouting, okay? Sometimes that's what you have to do. You just have to reroute yourself. And again, that takes time. And you know, sometimes when you reroute yourself, what happens, you're going to find out that, that wasn't such a good idea. So you're going to bounce off that one, and then you're going to reroute again. And what's going to happen is that you're going to have some failures that are actually going to be great victories, because those failures become things that you have learned from. You know, always be thinking, you know, what can I learn from this? What can I learn from this? You know, we need to do that with our blessings and our times of prosperity too. What can I learn from this? And then when we're suffering adversity, what can I learn from this? There is a passage that I wanted to mention before we take a brief break here that I think proves about that confliction thing that I had referenced. This is in 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter is a book that's obviously written to Christians who are struggling. There are numerous, in every chapter, there are five chapters in this 1 Peter letter. There are five chapters. In every one of these chapters, there are references to suffering, the sufferings of Jesus and their sufferings. In 1 Peter chapter 1, he's beginning to encourage them as they're struggling with really difficult suffering in their lives. And I want to pick up at verse 6 of chapter 1. I want you to notice something here. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Now, do you see a confliction, emotional confliction in verse 6? What are two emotions mentioned there that are polar opposites? Rejoice and grief in the same verse, experienced simultaneously. In this, you greatly rejoice. As a matter of fact, that joy is so tremendous, it's described down there in verse 8 as joy inexpressible and full of glory. It's like joy on steroids. So in this you greatly rejoice. You have joy in steroids. But you've been grieved by various trials. See, joy and grief experienced simultaneously. Now, what did he mean by in this you greatly rejoice? Well, you've got to go to the context. If you go to the context back in verse 3, look at what he has talked about. That's the in this. In this you greatly rejoice. In what? In the mercy, verse 3, the abundant mercy of God that's begotten us again to a living hope. There's mercy, there's hope. Verse 4, to an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that does not fade away. You've got mercy, hope, and an eternal inheritance. The providential care of God, verse 5, who are kept by the power of God through faith for the salvation. There's another blessing, ready to be revealed at the last time. There's mercy, hope, inheritance, the providential care of God, and salvation. In this, verse 6, in this, in what? In the spiritual blessings that we have, that no trial in our life can take from us. No trial in life can take from us. In this you greatly rejoice. Loss is a joy stealer. To a degree. Loss is a joy stealer. Because we have joy that is attached to some of the things we lose. Though you can concede that, no trial in your life can steal all of your joy if you're a Christian. It's impossible. Because the joy of a Christian is unseen and eternal. It's spiritual. It cannot be stolen from us by the trials of life, the losses that we experience, unless we let it. See, there's the intention, the choice, the purpose. In John chapter 9, and we'll close with this one, I promise. In John chapter 9, there is a story about this man that Jesus heals. An awful affliction. This man was blind from birth, John 9 and verse 1. And the question his disciples ask, people of faith, not the heathens, the people of faith, his disciples, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." Jesus was interested in purpose. The disciples were curious about cause. Jesus said, "No, let's not dwell on cause. Let's dwell on purpose." You can assign a purpose to every trial that you experience in life. You can assign a purpose to every loss that you've experienced in life. But that's an intentional thing. Do you know why that you are blessed? That the works of God could be displayed in you. Do you know why God permits you to be burdened? So that the works of God can be displayed in your life. The cause really doesn't matter. What matters is the purpose. And you know what? We're the ones that need to choose to assign that purpose to our difficulties. Let's take a break. We'll take about a 5-minute break, a short break, and then we're going to finish up at 11:30. Wasn't it scheduled 9 to 11:30? You know, I didn't check that this morning, seriously. 12, okay, good. Let's take a break till 11 o'clock and come back, and I'll get you out of here before 12. Let's take a break till straight up hour, 8 minutes. Remember about these things here on the table. Feel free to take any of these things on the table, but they're not forced upon you. Okay, could we go ahead and get started? I promise this will be the final session, and I feel pretty confident that we will get you out of here before noon. I don't want any of you fainting for lack of nourishment. I try not to be self-promoting, but and I know some people may view this as self-promoting, but I do want to do this as a part of the ministry. I have a ministry called the Widowhood Workshop Ministry. In that ministry, it's my family's passion project, my 3 daughters, my 2 sons-in-law, my 5 grandchildren, and Ranger and Sonny, the 2 Australian Labradoodles here in Gainesville. They're all part of the ministry. We all have things that we do within the ministry. You know, somebody is a webmaster. Somebody helps with a Facebook page. Somebody does the travel agent stuff. There's just all kinds of responsibilities with this ministry. My whole family is involved in it. It's the result of our reaction and our choices after the loss of my wife, their mother, their mother-in-law, and their Nana. And we're trying to permit the works of God to be displayed in our lives as a result of Ruth Ann's passing. A part of the ministry is doing widowhood workshops. And then a part of the ministry is doing living with loss workshops like this one. And then also we're trying to introduce people to good educational material like out there on that display table. Now, in addition to that, after I've been doing a lot of study in this area, I noticed that in the Brotherhood, there really isn't as much as I think there ought to be written about this subject. And so I have written 2 books about loss and about especially the loss of spouse. The first one is called When the End Comes, not the end of the world, the end of your marriage by death. It's When the End Comes Until Death Do Us Part. This second one that came out in July of this year is Before the End Comes Until Death Do Us Part. These books are both written in view of both the married people and the widowed people, and both married people and widowed people benefiting from it, and also people who are interested in knowing about how to minister effectively to people who are widowed. All of those kinds of folks would benefit from these books. My granddaughter, who lives here in Gainesville, Brooklyn Renee Sear, is sitting over here in this part of the auditorium. If you have an interest in looking at either one of these 2 books for purchase, Brooklyn is over there. I don't think she gets any percentage on the sale of the books. And I know that none of this money goes into my pocket. It goes into funding the ministry efforts, because sometimes when we go into a workshop, the church can be small or be in financial stress, not be able to even cover our expenses. So we can take care of that through the ministry fund. And the money, the profit from these books can help with the ministry fund. You can buy them on Amazon. Brooklyn has a few copies back there of each one of them. This one is typically on Amazon. This is $9. This is $8. You can get them digitally if you like to read that sort of a way. I hate to read on an iPad, but some people don't mind it. But you can get them for $5 if you want to get them that way through Amazon. But they're available for purchase if you'd like. The table over here that has all that display stuff, I happen to notice that we ran out of these tracks. I added some more in case you came to the table and these were not available. I put some more out here. This is a tract written by a couple of brothers in the Lord and physical brothers. As a matter of fact, they're twins. And when you see them, they're so big, you think, man, how did that mama ever survive that birth? Ron and Don Williams is their names. They have a great ministry that they do where they do workshops about grief, about Alzheimer's, about cancer. They have a great ministry that they are involved in. And they wrote this tract, How Can I Help Myself and Others in Times of Grief? These tracts we buy, our ministry buys from them, and then we make them available for no expense to folks who come to any of our workshops. And so those are out there. I replenish that pile. Let me share with you a quote from a book called How to Go Shopping with Your Wife and Enjoy It. The title of this book captured my attention because I used to brag about the fact that I had more miles on my pedometer than any man on the face of the earth because of all the time I spent in malls with my wife. And it really caught my attention. How to Go Shopping with Your Wife and Enjoy It. It's a book about marriage is what it's about. And here is a quote from that book. I thought this was interesting. It applies to some of what we've been talking about in regard to what other people experience. And you know how I discourage anybody from saying, I know how you feel, that kind of thing. Let me read to you this quote. Each of us lives inside of his or her own skin. No one can get inside there with us. We are all alone, and no one knows what we are experiencing inside. The only way someone can know what we are experiencing is for us to convey a message to them, letting them know. One of the things I wish that I had done as a local preacher in Hartville, Ohio, is I wish that after loss, I would have spent more time privately asking some of these people about their life after their loss. I wish I would have done that. What I saw and observed and experienced with them was their loss and the impact of their loss. What I didn't talk to them enough about was what it was like living after their loss. And so because of that, I wasn't as effective as a servant to them and as a brother in the Lord to them, wasn't as effective in my ministry to them because I wasn't inside of them. And you know, for somebody to share with you what's really going on in their life, you've got to have a relationship. You know, we're not going to spill our guts to somebody that we don't feel like we have a relationship with. One of the things that we need to do in our families and in our church families is we need to cultivate a degree or a depth of fellowship that is such that there is a high degree of transparency. You know, transparency in communication and in our relationships, transparency is a sign of intimacy. And don't think about intimacy in the sense of sex. I mean intimacy in the sense of closeness. Transparency is a sign of intimacy. It also is something that helps to cultivate intimacy. But we're not going to be transparent with people about how we really feel unless we have a relationship with them where we feel comfortable sharing with them about how we really feel. You know, there are times in talking to a lot of people who've experienced loss, in recognition of the loss, sometimes people will come to them and say, well, how do you feel? And what they mean about, you know, that is, how do you feel now in light of the fact that you've lost so-and-so in your life? And a lot of times, you know, what are our classic responses to that? Fine. Great. Okay. I think sometimes, this is a pretty strong way of putting it, sometimes we're really good liars. You know, there are times that, you know, like when we sometimes meet somebody and we say, well, how are you? You know, that has become the courteous thing to say to somebody. Now, do we really know Do we really want to know how they feel? You know as well as I do, there are some people you wouldn't even ask that question to because you don't want to be with them for half an hour. So there are some things that we just kind of say. I think one of the things that's really good for us to do in our life after our loss is when people inquire about how we're doing, tell them really how we're doing. Be honest about it. You know, if you're really struggling today, let them know that. How in the world could I, as a friend of yours or a brother in the Lord or a member of your family, how could I be as effective as I need to be in helping you if I really don't know what's going on with you? One of the reasons why people who experience loss are neglected, they get inadequate support and help, is because we don't know what they're going through. There's not that openness and transparency in our relationships. I can't minister to somebody effectively if I don't have a clue about what they're going through. So being more transparent is a very, very good thing to cultivate in our relationships. What's it like living after loss? What's it like? You know, there are things that you feel and things that you experience when you suffer loss. Okay, so what I want to ask you about, I want you to maybe share some thoughts about this, is what's it like? Some of you have experienced loss in your life. What's it like? Name for me some things that you feel you would feel or maybe have felt or experienced after loss. Anybody? Pain, okay? Pain. Alone. Yeah, loneliness. Guilt. Guilt, okay. Anger. I remember, speaking of anger, I remember this lady in Titusville, Florida, telling me about sometimes when she took a shower, she would feel compelled to beat the side of the shower wall, and she would cry out, "Why did you leave me? Why?" And she would keep beating the side of the shower. "Why did you leave me?" Well, it's not like he chose to, but see, that was her feeler speaking. She was kind of letting it out, and she felt very alone. He didn't choose to leave her. He died. Anger, yeah. How about something else that you might feel or experience?
Depression.
Maybe even desperation. And you know, hey, by the way, I was in Murray City, Tennessee, where we developed a great widowhood ministry locally over there in West Tennessee. We had people sometimes from four counties who would drive to our fellowships that we had there. And about half of them were not members of the Lord's church. They were members of all kinds of different churches that came there. And one night, before we concluded, I said, "Does anybody want to say anything or ask anything or have a prayer request before we dismiss?" There was a lady named Rachel there who raised her hand, and she said, "Is anybody else here on depression meds?" And I said, "Well, Rachel, I don't know." And so I had cultivated a really good relationship with those people who attended that regularly. And I said, "Well, how many of you are on depression meds?" And there was about a third of the group that raised her hand. Now, why do you think she asked that question? Why did Rachel even bring up that question? She was depressed. She was taking depression meds and maybe feeling guilty because she shouldn't need that because she's a Christian. She's got faith. People of faith shouldn't need depression meds. I remember going, my primary care physician in Ohio was a member of the church. He was a deacon at the church where I preached. His name was Todd. And during my caregiving experience with my wife, one day when I was there to visit, he said, "Dean, do you need depression meds?" He said, I'll prescribe some depression meds for you." And I said, "Well, Todd, give me a little bit longer. I'll think about it." I certainly wasn't opposed to it. It's just, you know how men, prideful men are. You know, "I think I can do this." I ended up not getting the depression meds. But one thing that we have got to help all of us understand culturally is there is no shame or disgrace in being depressed. And there's no shame or disgrace in being diagnosed with clinical depression or any other mental illness for that matter. you shouldn't be ashamed that you get cancer or that you get Alzheimer's. There are mental diseases or afflictions, emotional ones, and there are physical ones. And we shouldn't be ashamed to feel in need. And sometimes that depression med route can be a very helpful thing for a while. Yeah, Mark. Yeah. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Yeah. Like everybody else, like normal. Yeah. Like they're abnormal. Yeah, it's just, it's a shame that it's that way. And there are times, one of the things that you may experience after loss is kind of feeling like a character in the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer animated movie where they had the island of misfit toys. You can kind of feel like a misfit because you have this issue that you have. You're dealing with something that's unique, you think, to you. Yes, ma'am. So a psychiatrist said to his patients, don't tell people you have a mental illness. Why would he instruct that? Ron, did you want to make a comment about that since you have a background in this academically? Yeah, there can be a stickiness to a diagnosis, and you get labeled, and then you have to deal with that in a world where you feel like you're a misfit because you've been diagnosed. I'd like for us to think about this, about feelings and experiences after loss, and what are they like? What I'd love to encourage you to do, I usually do this in grief workshops, but this is totally my fault that we're not doing it this time, because I forgot, frankly. But cut me some slack. I'm 68 years old, okay? How many of you have seen Steel Magnolias, the movie Steel Magnolias? I'm telling you what, I love movies. I love to watch movies where they're Southern women. They talk funny, and they behave kind of weird. I love, Steel Magnolias is just one of my favorite movies. A lot of times in these Living with Loss workshops, I will play the cemetery scene. You can go on YouTube, and in the search bar, plug in cemetery scene, Steel Magnolias. Oh, I'll tell you what, that is some tremendous acting. That was a great cast of characters. I mean, they did a great job of casting that movie. But I tell you, that cemetery scene is, there is so much learning that can go on. It is so consistent with human behavior. You know, Sally Field loses her daughter. She's at the cemetery. And Sally Field and the way she portrays that loss and those friends of hers and the way they interact with her right there at the cemetery, it's just really fascinating. And there's a lot of things you can learn by watching that scene. I encourage you sometime if you go home today, just Google that or get that on YouTube. Cemetery scene, Steel Magnolias. That'll take you right to it. Okay, what about feelings and what about experiences after loss? Now, I want to thank my grandson, Evan Sear, who is taking a class where he knows how to do this kind of stuff. This really cool way of getting stuff to appear just magically by pushing the button. Thank the Lord for middle school. Okay, you experience loss. What do you experience after that? Well, you experience grief. But now, wait a minute. There could also be relief. So give me a scenario where you could imagine somebody suffering loss and feeling relief. Why in the world? Because when we lose people, we're supposed to be experiencing grief, right? So if you experience relief, you're going to be in confliction. You know, that is one of the greatest blessings, the gifts that you can give to somebody who's dying at the appropriate time. Share with them the fact that it's okay if they don't want to fight anymore to live. Sometimes that can be the best gift you can give them toward the end. I was sitting at a lectureship in a class where this guy was talking about caregiving and about helping and supporting caregivers. I talked to him privately afterwards about this particular issue that I had. I don't think I've even shared this with my daughters. But when You know, I was exhausted during the caregiving period of time and stressed out, and I felt like I was going to snap on a number of occasions. When she died, when she breathed her last breath, there was the weirdest sense of ecstasy that I experienced for a very brief period of time. It was like ecstasy. That's the only word I can use to describe it. It was over. The caregiving part was over. You know, then I had to wake up to the reality. But I talked to this guy after this class at this lectureship I attended, and he said, and he's interacted with a lot of caregivers, he said, that is not an uncommon reaction. You know, when you've caregived for a good while and been through that experience, it is not an uncommon thing to feel a great deal of relief. There are things that contribute to your sense of relief, just like there are things that contribute to your sense of grief. You know, you take, for instance, what about a woman who's been experiencing domestic violence and her husband dies? You think she's going to feel some relief about that? An abusive spouse? There are scenarios and situations where there's going to be a combination of relief and grief. Sometimes, more often than not probably, you would expect much more grief than relief. But there are some situations where there might be a lot of relief and maybe less grief than relief. But again, that's that internal confliction. We've got to realize that internal confliction, that's very human. It's normal. It's okay. It's okay. I love the way one young lady put it. Her husband had committed suicide. She was in her 20s. They had a child about a year and a half old. Buffy is her name. Her husband took his life. And I love how that she sometimes says in this private Facebook group that I created, she sometimes says, it's okay to not be okay. I just love the way she puts that. It's okay not to be okay. It is okay not to be okay. She's exactly right. And there's pain and heartache like we've never experienced before. We may have experienced other losses, but we've never experienced this loss. Every loss is individual. We've never lost this person. Or we've never lost this particular thing that we highly valued. There can be guilt, and there can be regret. What's the difference between guilt and regret? Anybody have some ideas about that? The difference between regret and guilt. Ron? Sorrow over what I did, guilt, okay? Regret is what sorrow over what I did not do. Good distinction. Yes, ma'am, there in the back. Okay. Can you live life without regret? If you want to shoot that high, good luck. That's what I say. There is a chapter in this book about before the end comes. There's a chapter in this book about the subject of regret. And basically, what I mention in this book is the concept that you cannot live life without regrets. Chapter 8 is titled this way, Reduce Regrets. Not eliminate regrets. But you can reduce regrets by prepping for certain things in an effective way. But there's going to be regrets that you're going to have. And you may even feel some guilt. Now, also we need to remember that I think there's a big difference between guilt and what I call self-inflicted guilt, which is not real guilt. It's like regret on steroids. You know, sometimes we make ourselves feel guilty when we're really not. You know, there are times that we really are guilty. But then there are times when we're not really guilty, but we feel that way. It's like a self-inflicted kind of a guilt. It's kind of like regret on steroids. But, you know, again, that's the human condition. We're struggling after loss. Now, what about sleeplessness? And then you've got the other end of the spectrum, sleepiness. I remember after Ruth Ann died, my body craved sleep. I think I could have slept. I probably slept After the kids all went back to their different places in January of 2014, I'll bet there were days I slept 15 hours. And that went on for several days. Other people have told me about how that they just can't sleep. Very restless. Tossing and turning, and they just can't get themselves to go to sleep. I used to tell my mother-in-law, who would sometimes drive me up a wall, my wife was gone, my parents were gone, it was just me and my mother-in-law, and she would talk about the things that would cause her not to be able to go to sleep. And I would tell, I always addressed her as Mama Bear. I said, Mama Bear, just turn your brain off. We had the kind of relationship where I could poke fun at her, and, you know, we just had a great relationship. And I said, Mama Bear, just turn your brain off. And I kept challenging her, turn your brain off. And then after saying that numerous times, it dawned on me, if God had given us the ability to turn our brain off, you'd better tell somebody else to turn it back on, because you wouldn't know to turn it back on. But sometimes I have that problem when I wake up during the night. When I wake up during the night, sometimes things will enter my brain, and I just, you know, it could be 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning, and my brain starts kicking into gear, and I just want to shut it down, but I can't. And I just toss and I turn. You have that magnified, either the sleepiness or the sleeplessness. You have that magnified because you've gone through loss. You know, a part of your life has been stolen from you. A chunk of your heart has been taken away from you. And you're dealing with a lot of really important life issues. You've got worries and fears. What is your life going to be like now? What are you going to do now? This whole business of getting to a new beginning, you know, you've got to decide what your new beginning is. What do you want with your new beginning? At some point in time, if this aisle were your grief journey, and this is your loss back here, and you're going on your grief journey, at some point in time, what you've got to do is decide that I've come to a fork in the road of my life, and I've got to make a decision. And the first big decision is, what do I want for the rest of my life? I prayed fervently about 3 things when my wife passed away. These were 3 priorities of mine in my prayer life. I prayed that the Lord would open a door of opportunity for me to continue to serve Him and to be a minister. Number 2, I prayed that the Lord would give me the courage to walk through the door, and the Lord would give me the vision to see the open door. You know, we worry a lot about things that we don't know everything about. And your future, you don't know everything about. But if you want a new beginning, you have to conceive of what is that new beginning. And then you have to figure out, okay, how do I get to this new beginning? Well, I'm just so thankful that there was this little church in West Tennessee that was willing to take me in, despite my age, despite the fact that I didn't have a wife, despite the fact I was a Yankee. They talked funny there. And they accepted me. And I was so thankful that I had that door of opportunity open there. But it's, you know, you just have a lot of worries and fears. A lot of it's about your present and your future. And so you've got to deal with all of those. The role of the Holy Spirit. Well, hopefully, and I think it is so important to realize that there's a storm, but there's a time before the storm. And the time before the storms in our life are times when we need to be cultivating a very intimate walk with the Lord, so that our life is described like this in Galatians chapter 5. Let me note a couple of passages here. Thank you for bringing that issue up. In Galatians chapter 5, the admonition in verse 16 is, walk in the Spirit. Then there's a discussion about being led by the Spirit, verse 18. Walk in the Spirit, Galatians 5:16. Be led by the Spirit, in Galatians 5, verse 18. Then it talks about in verse 22, the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness. And then verse 25, if we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. One of the ways of describing the Christian life is us choosing to be led by the Spirit, to walk in the Spirit. The way to do that is to absorb that Spirit into our life. The Spirit has given us direction, teaching, wisdom. We imbibe that into our life. We absorb that into our life. And we walk in the Spirit, and we permit ourselves to be led by His Spirit. And that's important to do prior to the time that you experience the loss. If you wait until the time you experience your loss to get serious about your relationship with the Lord and being led by the Spirit, then you're going to struggle a whole lot more than the person who's prepped for that by living in the Spirit and being led by the Spirit previous to the storm. Anybody here have trouble crying? Does anybody here have a physiological problem crying? Do you know there are people who can't cry? Now, I have an affliction that's not on the medical documents. Now, let me explain. I have three daughters. Okay, I was married for 41 years. I have three daughters, and I have four grandchildren. I only have one grandson. I suffer from what's called overexposure to the female gender. Now, I'm not a normal male, okay? And I admit that, but there's a reason why. That overexposure to the male, to the female gender will not create a normal male. I'm not a normal male. It's hard for me not to tear up when I'm watching a Hallmark movie. Can we delete that part out of the recording? I've morphed into that kind of a person, guy. I shed a lot of tears. I shed a lot of tears with other people. I can tear up pretty quickly. When I experience difficult times or I get very worried or I experience losses. Have you ever had a crying fit when you were praying? You know, you can be so overwhelmed by the things that you're experiencing in your life, you can't get your words out. I remember a number of times after my wife passed away, wanting to verbalize my gratitude to him for the 41 years I had my wife, and I couldn't get it out. I cracked. I couldn't verbalize those. I was so emotional and so tearful, I couldn't get those words out. I can get those words out now. But what do we say when we start tearing up in the presence of somebody else? I'm sorry. I think we've earned the right to tear up by some of the things we've experienced in our life. What do we have to apologize for? Nothing. That is a natural and normal reaction of a human being, to tear up. There's no need to apologize. I understand why we apologize. A lot of times that's probably prompted by the fact we've been in the presence of other people who've said that. So we kind of adopt that philosophy in our own life. And maybe sometimes we say it because we don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. Maybe that's another reason why we might say that. But when we've suffered loss, we've earned the right to cry anytime, anywhere, including right here in this room. It can be very hard going to church after you've suffered great loss. It can be very hard. As a matter of fact, for those of you who are widowed, I have, I think, knowledge and personal relationships with more widowed people than the normal person does. And I can say this without fear of contradiction. Generally speaking, the two hardest places for a widowed person to go is to bed and to church. I know people, both male and female, after they've suffered the loss of their spouse, slept for months on the couch because they couldn't go back to the bedroom. I know one guy that months after he slept on the couch, he only went back to the bedroom after he reinvented that bedroom and it became like a man cave with a big honking deer on the wall. His wife would have never permitted that in their bedroom. But, you know, And then I know coming to church, we think of it as a place of love, praise, encouragement. But if you've been going to church with somebody for years, and then you come alone. One guy at the Laverne, Tennessee church, I met him just the other day. As a matter of fact, he and I are going to work together to help the Laverne church start an ongoing widowhood ministry there. He sits about right there. His name's Harry Anderson. And you know when he comes to church, do you know what he brings with him? He brings a picture of his wife in a frame, and it sits right there. A couple Sunday nights ago, I sat with him at church. He sets it right there. When we met together at a widowhood fellowship a few weeks ago in Nashville, Tennessee, he had that picture with him too. He said everywhere he goes, he has that picture of his wife with him. You know, it can be very hard coming to church after we've lost. You know one thing I miss in coming to church? Is I miss when we are praying publicly in the assembly. I miss holding her hand. As a matter of fact, I was sitting right over there one Sunday night. I don't remember how long ago this was. Some of you know Carla Kelly, who has been involved in the ministry and mission efforts here at church. She lives in Middle Tennessee. But we were sitting over there. It was Sunday night at church. We were here together. And we were sitting there. And when we started to pray publicly, she did first what I was going to do, but she was quicker. She reached over and held my hand. She's a widow. She lost her husband in her 50s. You know, there are things that you experience that are very different after you've experienced loss. You know, with the loss of a child, going somewhere can be very difficult because that's where you went with your child. It could have been his or her favorite place to go. Yeah, if you have that loved one's body right here, then when you come to worship, what are you going to see? It's not going to be there, but what are you going to see? And there are going to be things that are going to prompt tears. And you may struggle with not tearing up because, and there are some people who cannot physiologically cry. You can Google that one. You're going to have questions. Questions about yourself, questions about other people, questions about God. I have a very different perspective about a lot of things, including God, because of some of my life experiences. You're going to have social awkwardness. People are not, do you know that one of the common things about people who suffered loss is their social network, what we nowadays call their social network, takes a tremendous hit. It's reduced significantly. They don't know what to do with you if you've suffered loss. And if they know that you've suffered loss, they don't know what to do with you. What do I say? What do I do? See, all this ignorance that we have about grief and us avoiding this subject has contributed to us backing away from, instead of going to, backing away from these people because we don't know what to do or say, and we don't want to hurt them. And so when that situation evolves, what we do is we back away, and we think, well, we're not going to do any damage that way. But there's going to be some social awkwardness involved, and you're probably going to struggle with rebuilding, having to rebuild your social network. I'm kind of weird, I've admitted that. My prized possessions are not things that most people would prize. This is a prized possession of mine. It's an old beat-up rear-view mirror. I bought it a few months ago at a flea market in Northeast Ohio, in Hartville, Ohio, that I was visiting with a friend of mine. Yes, yes. I shouldn't feel guilty about this? Don't put my stuff on eBay. Well, this one cost me $1. But I've been looking for one of these, and I was going to have to go to a junkyard and probably take one off of a vehicle. They'd send me out to the junkyard to take it off myself. But I happened to find it. I only had to pay $1 for it. Now, the reason why I bring this up is there are times, just like she mentioned dates, there are times and occasions when one of the great blessings is to look in the rearview mirror of your life. You know, when you're moving forward, you know, when you're driving on the interstate, you've got this big honking windshield that you're looking out of all the time, and it helps you to see where you're at and where you're headed. Now, there are occasions when you're driving forward, if you're going to get there safely, it's important to look in the rearview mirror. When do you need to look in the rearview mirror when you're driving on the interstate? Somebody give me an example. okay, if you're going to change lanes, you know, there might be somebody coming, you know, 85 miles an hour behind you. You need to make sure if you're going to change lanes, okay? There are other occasions. Have you ever passed something and then looked in the rearview mirror? Thought, what? Why is that blue light special back there? You know, and you there when you're moving forward, you need to keep your primary vision on the windshield. But there are occasions in moving forward, you need to look in the rearview mirror of your life. There are anniversaries and birthdays. And for me, May 1st. May 1st, at 127 East Front Street in Dover, Ohio, was the first time I ever kissed my girlfriend, who became my wife. You know, I can't help but think about that. I even have a picture of exactly where that was. You know, there are certain things that we've experienced and people we've experienced them with that are etched in our memory because of either maybe the season of the year or the date. And when those things come, we need to realize that looking in that rearview mirror for a while is very, very helpful if we're going to move forward successfully and safely. You know, it's okay sometimes to just pull off to the side of the road and look in the rearview mirror. And there are dates and occasions when we need to do that. One of the handouts here is about that very thing, about dealing with special occasions and anniversaries, birthdays, and things like that. It's very good to look in the rearview mirror. Sometimes we have dreams. It is not an uncommon thing for years and even decades after a loss for us to dream about people. Most of the widowed people that I interact with have told me that most of the time their dreams are kind of like visits. They're positive things. They kind of hate when they end and they wake up and they realize it's only a dream. I've had some very real dreams. You know, when people have become so much a part of your life and then they're no longer there, it's a human, you know, you do not have control over what you dream about. You know, can you feel off the hook here? You know, you don't have to feel guilty because you dream about something. You know, your mind just does its own thing when you go to sleep. But you very naturally have dreams. And that can go on for years and years and years. And that's perfectly normal. You're not going crazy. There's nothing wrong with you. There's emptiness that you feel because that person's no longer there. And you're going to experience these grief triggers that we've talked about. Some of the people who write about this talk about waves, about grief waves or grief triggers. And you might experience some anger, and some of that anger might even be directed toward God, because it is true. It's hard to get a grip on this. You know, you can wrap your brain around this, but it's hard to wrap your heart around this fact. God did let it happen. He did let it happen. He permits everything that happens in this world to happen. That doesn't mean that he desires it to happen. Please remember, not everything that happens in this world is God's will, in the sense of that's what he wanted. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. He does have a desire. And we've got to decide how to live that desire he has in our life after our loss. And we can be hypersensitive after we've experienced loss. People are going to say things that are just out of place and wrong and hurtful. And they're going to do things. You're going to be neglected. In our culture, generally speaking, in our culture, and especially in the church, this is true, we are very good at immediate care. We are outstanding, I think, in regard to immediate care. Where we are pitiful is long-term care. Oh, we're pitiful. We're pitiful with that. One of the things that I would suggest you do, I do this with some people. Obviously, you can't do this with everybody you know. But in my calendar, I'll mark down certain dates. Like I'll have the date, I'll have the name of somebody. It might be Rhonda, for instance, November 11, the date of her father or her husband's passing. And then you call that person on that day, on that occasion. People, and even in families, there's this problem. When people have suffered loss, it's very therapeutic and most frequently desirable that we talk about that person that we've lost. It's not a hurtful thing, it's a helpful thing. But sometimes we think it's a hurtful thing because we see tears because we initiate this conversation, but those tears are okay too. And one of the things that we want to do is talk about that person who's passed on. But you have this hypersensitivity where sometimes you feel neglected, and sometimes you're hurt by what people say or do or don't do, and it's just extremely difficult. It's just very confusing. And it's not uncommon, let's just admit it, it's not uncommon to have a faith struggle because of what we've experienced in our life. This poor father, you know, struggling with what he's seen with his son. You know, he's agonized about this for years. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Did he believe or did he not believe? Well, he was struggling with his faith. And it's okay to struggle with your faith because you know what? Your faith can become stronger. The fact is this. H. Norman Wright is right. Loss changes you. The neat thing about that fact is you get to decide how it changes you. It can cause you to feel bitter. It can cause you to decide to leave the Lord and live as a heathen and a person of the world. You can also choose to seek passionately God like you've never done before and seek his help and strength and wisdom. But loss does change us, but we get to decide how it changes us in the long run. It's going to impact us. It's going to be grueling initially, but in the long run, we get to decide how it changes us. We can have ourselves changed in a way that God's glorified because of our reaction. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for your love and thank you, Father, for your care. Your blessings are too numerous to count. Your blessings are certainly beyond our ability to value. Father, we know that what's important is the unseen and the eternal. Help us to constantly remind ourselves about that. Father, as we struggle with the things that we struggle with in this life, help us to be reasonable and help us to be rational and help us to be honest about the fact that we're just human and it's okay to struggle and it's okay not to be okay. Help us to realize that you are what we need in our life. More than anything or anybody, we need you, Father. And help us to seek you with a passion in prosperity and in adversity. Father, we pray that we will make wise choices in the midst of our storms and after we try to live after our loss. Help us to make wise choices, to be led by the teachings of your Spirit. And it's in the name of Jesus that we pray. Amen.